Welcome back, everyone, to Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm your host, Doug Kameen, and today I'm talking with Nick Bialyshevsky, who is an operating partner at Orchid Black. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks, Doug.
Great to have you here. So leading into this, of course, right before we get on, you've got, I mean, it's a great Polish name, but it is a bear to pronounce, right? So like, I had to sit and practice to make sure that I got it right. How did I do this time?
You did great. And I coached you through it. It's the same role I've been doing since kindergarten.
That's right. You know, and my last name, I'm Kameen, but everybody wants to pronounce my name as Kamen as well. Mm-hmm. So you and I are in the same, a similar boat, although yours is taking the cake for complexity, for awesome complexity. So Nick, you've been in a lot of different roles over the years. And just for the listeners out here on the podcast, I'm gonna give a little bit of inside baseball. Nick and I know each other. So like we've worked together in a couple of different roles, doing some projects. So I have a little bit of inside baseball to know a little bit more about Nick's background than maybe the average guest we have on this podcast. But you really specialize and you love doing work in lean work, really. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about like the work you're doing and where you're kind of doing leadership in that space right now?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, really, like what I really enjoy right now is working with companies who are trying to meet some kind of audacious goal and are struggling to do it because parts of their business aren't talking to each other. A few years ago, I was introduced to the Scaled Agile framework, SAFe, which is kind of what you were just mentioning with the the lean stuff. And I was really struck by how well it provided kind of a framework and kind of like a taxonomy for the problems that we're trying to solve today. You know, building software or organizing businesses, strictly around in my interest right now is just like in how we convey ideas, how we manage scope. You know, if you take a big like cyber physical product is a great example, but even as something as simple as a web application, how do you break mm-hmm. that down into what are your hypotheses about it, what capabilities are you looking for, what's the value proposition for the product, how does that break down logically and physically into what you're building? And Scaled Agile framework I thought like gave some really, really cool tools for that. Kind of fell into that happenstance way. Before that I was doing like agile consulting and dev tools consulting, and happened upon the Scaled Agile framework. But my background is a software engineer. So I think that's why I like it, is that it probably addresses so many of the different things that I always felt were wrong about either companies I worked for or projects that I was on, doing the implementation.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to, go right down into the depths of where have you been working and like, what have you been doing? And so you're in different leadership roles right now. And, you're actually, I think if I'm looking, I'm cheating here on LinkedIn, looking at your profile, but you're really kind of doing two different things at the moment. There's you're a VP of engineering for a retail store or a place called Restore.
Restore for Retail. It's a
Restore for Retail.
Retail tech software company.
Nice. So, and you're an operating partner at Orchid Black, which is a consultancy firm that does a wide variety of different strategy consulting work. So what, going back in the past, you've had different leadership positions. Can you maybe like kind of walk us through, where did you come into leadership in the IT space and the software engineering space specifically?
Well, when I was finishing my computer science degree, I was working as a network and systems admin. And before that, I had done an internship with the Coast Guard as a software developer. And at both of those places, I had run-ins with DBAs, database administrators. And
yeah.
And I just, there was an aura about DBAs, particularly the ones at the Coast Guard. And it's like, I don't know why, but it's just like I gravitated to the people that did like the database stuff, the most hardcore stuff on the team, that usually kind of had this like Superman type attitude, could answer any kind of questions. So
I feel like there's an aura of anything at the Coast Guard. Seems like a really cool place to intern, by the way.
It was an amazing place to intern. Well, that's another story too. But I mean, I got that opportunity. It was the second day of a 2-day career fair at my university, and I didn't have any kind of interview set up. I didn't even have a resume with me. I think I went up and talked to someone. And they're like, "Hey, come back tomorrow for interviews." And I'm like, "Okay, cool." I wrote a resume that day and got it. But no, it was an amazing opportunity while I was still in college. But you know, that experience and the work that I did working in IT while I finished my degree, I really wanted to go to a place where I could do a little bit of what I did in IT, but also in the software space. So I ended up moving up. I was going to college at WVU, so I moved up to Pittsburgh, and I took a job as a DBA, as a SQL production DBA, and completely loved my job. But within a couple of months, I was given the opportunity to take over the dev team. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like being right out of college, that promotion probably hurt more than it helped.
This is going to be the first place I'm going to explore about how this is a great, because I had this same thing too, where what happened mm-hmm. to me, like at 26, I was managing like 10 people. And I think about 26-year-old or 25-year-old me managed 10 people and 45-year-old me managed 10 people. And I'm like, ooh, you know, like not entirely. I mean, I was okay, but there were a lot of things when I look back, I'm like, there was some things I could have, if I had only known.
Like, yeah. I mean, honestly, like, I feel actually ironically like I had a lot better poker face and more patience back then sometimes. But like now, like nowadays I find myself, if you catch me on a bad day, like a sleepless night, you know, the day after a sleepless night, like I feel like I get so focused on the professionalism and the pressure of what we do sometimes that I feel like sometimes, even when I was a manager just starting out, it's like, didn't have all the pressures of life that I have now, you know, and all the things that go on. But yeah, I mean, that's how I got into leadership. I was given a development team, probably to keep me at an organization when I was pretty young in my career. And, I ended up staying there for quite a while. You know, actually that was the first place I got exposure to any kind of like automated CI/CD and DevOps type stuff. It was a nonprofit organization. We had like 70 custom apps and I got all of those things on pipelines before we left and, you know, fixed a lot of technical problems. But yeah, the mark that I left there, I can't say that I made people a lot better than how I found them.
At Dissecting Popular IT Nerds, we expect to win and we expect our IT directors to win. And one of those areas where we know that we can help you win is internet service providers. As an IT director tasked with managing internet connectivity, few vendor relationships can prove more painfully frustrating than the one with your internet service provider. The array of challenges seems never ending, from unreliable uptime and insufficient bandwidth to poor customer service and hidden fees. It's like getting stuck in rush hour traffic. Dealing with ISPs can try one's patience even on the best of days. So whether you are managing one location or 100 locations, our back office support team and vendor partners are the best in the industry. And the best part about this is none of this will ever cost you a dime due to the partnership and the sponsors that we have behind the scenes at Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. Let us show you how we can manage away the mediocrity and hit it out of the park. We start by mapping all of the available fiber routes, and we use our $1.2 billion in combined customer buying power and massive economy of scale to map all of your locations, to overcome construction fees, to use industry historical data, to encourage providers to compete for the lowest possible pricing, to negotiate the lowest rates guaranteed, and to provide fast response times in hours, not days. And we leverage aggregators and wholesale relationships to ensure you get the best possible pricing available in the marketplace. And on top of all of this, you get proactive network monitoring and proactive alerts so that you're not left calling 1-800-GO-POUND-SAND to enter in a ticket number and wonder, why is my internet connection down? In short, we are the partner that you have always wanted, who understands your needs, your frustrations, and knows what you need without you having to ask. So we're still human, but we are some of the best and we aim to win. This all starts with a value discovery call where we find out what you have, why you have it, and what's on your roadmap. All you need to do is email internet@popularit.net and say, I want help managing all of my internet garbage. Please make my life easier and we'll get right on it for you. Have a wonderful day.
So now what types of things did you, so these are early lessons in your career now. I mean, this is, you know, 15, almost going on 20 years ago now, not quite, you know, looking at it, but you said you leave people, you left people better than when you started. What did you do to achieve that?
Well, I don't think I did it at that place. I think I set a high bar. I think I fixed a lot of problems. And then I kind of went to go find myself.
I misheard what you said, that you were saying you didn't leave people as great as you might have hoped now.
Yeah. Yeah. I was saying, I think my legacy there was, I made technical improvements and, you know, fixed the bridge, so to speak, but I don't know that I left the passengers in any better state. That's where I was saying, I think that hurt more than it helped, because, you know, you leave a job like that. It's like, oh, I had this team. It's like, I must be capable. You know, I was given a commission, you know, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I ended up leaving there. I went to Carnegie Mellon Software Engineering Institute, where I had no team. And I was very much like the most junior person, on the group. I was working with PhDs and, you know, engineers in their 50s and stuff. And my boss was an author, and it was a completely different environment. And academia wasn't industry. Like, I get there on my first day, and it's like, what do I do? And they're like, hang on, it's just, why don't you slow down? And here's your set of textbooks, you know. And it was like, send me to my private office or whatever. But my role there was actually on the team software process. So basically what this group did, all these PhDs, they could take any software project that's going on, just say you're 2 months into an 18-month project, they could estimate when you'll finish, how done you'll be, how big your product will be, where all the defects will be, and which parts of your process were most responsible for removing them and inserting them, injection and removal. My role on that team was to basically understand TSP and PSP, personal software process, through and through, along with all the statistics, you know, you needed to measure things like defect density and process yield and stuff. And we would work with really hypercritical organizations where they were building software that, you know, you couldn't necessarily patch a defect. Like, for instance, like, think about the software that runs your pump that medication goes through when you're in the hospital. You know, it's like or the brakes on your car or trading engine that, you know, like, you know, would hold the value to your 401k and all this kind of stuff. It's like
they cannot fail, basically.
Well, they can't fail, but it's also like the distribution environment means that you'll never be able to update it. Like, how are you going to update my pacemaker, you know, if you made a little issue, you know? And it was pretty cool because I learned a lot about software quality and about how to manage quality. Like, the first thing I was asked is like, have you ever measured software quality? It's like, well, I've counted bugs. And it's like, well, no, I'm talking about defects, you know, like what part of your process and what type and what reason, you know, is responsible for the defective nature of your yield. You know, and it's like, I just never thought of it this way. But that was probably the biggest thing that helped me to go and correct my mistake of what I was saying earlier about, like, I left my team probably not a lot better off than when I found them. That when I left Carnegie Mellon, I joined another local Pittsburgh, well-known software company. It was probably one of the better software companies in Pittsburgh called Confluence. And I felt like I was working with stallions, like nothing but stallions work there, like outstanding engineers through and through. They'd probably all laugh if they heard me talking about them this way, but, I had like major imposter syndrome when I went there, even though I had, you know, run a team before. I had come from Carnegie Mellon, but these guys are so good, but, you know, they didn't really have the predictability. They didn't have like the consistency. So one of the hardest things I ever did as a leader was just as an engineer on this team, you know, just a regular engineer, I got them to log our defects, you know, and some of the things they were saying is that nobody's saying that we're not, you know, creating good estimates or anything like that. But, you know, I could tell like scientifically, we just had no proof of it. But what we started doing though was like, instead of like building some software, finishing the sprint and then releasing it, and then if we got some defects, you know, or some bugs that were sent back, you know, log them. Our process was like intra sprint. in the middle of your sprint, if you were at a code review and you found a situation that you did not design for or something you didn't plan for, we would log a design defect or we'd log a planning defect. And one of our quality engineers would help us review them at the end of our sprint review, such that we're able to have every individual engineer that injected a defect, you know, was able to remove it, meaning we didn't release any defects. We also didn't repeat any of the same mistakes. We went 18 months. We never missed a single release. We didn't miss any scope we had planned for that release, and we never let a defect escape. That was 100% process yield sustained for 18 months.
That's pretty amazing.
I'm still extremely proud of that. And then after that, I spent a decade in consulting, and I've never seen another team get that close. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was an example of just like, you know, you don't have to be the boss to be the leader, but, you know, and it's not even saying that was the home run. Like there were a million other metrics of success for that product, but I'm really proud of how we approached and managed the quality very professionally.
Mm-hmm. So now when you were leading the teams in these places, and I'm going to draw a contrast to one versus the other, because you've highlighted it early on. You feel like you technically led well, but maybe didn't, you know, empathy lead well, if you will, you know, or the variety of like the human factors related to leadership. But you learned and you adapted and you changed your approach and your tactics, and you felt that, you know, then you went on this, you were on a part of a team that had an 18-month run of zero defects, producing at such a high level. What wasn't, I'll ask this two-sided, what didn't you do well, like back before, you know, and I'm more specific, like not just like a general, well, I didn't like the treat of the team really well, but like what would, you know, so like people are listening to this podcast and they're saying like, if I can see this in my actions and what I'm doing in a leadership level, I know that's like, that's probably a red flag.
Actually, I'm glad I'm talking to you about this, because you're helping me realize I'm learning this lesson all over again today. You know, it's like, you know, with that, the Restore for Retail role, is that my issue between job one and what is job three in this case is there's a difference between taking responsibility for something that you want and being given responsibility. I think in the former role, I was given the responsibility, and I, you know, I looked at that like, oh, okay, I'm anointed to make these kind of choices. You know, I didn't realize it until after, and I thought, well, what's a big deal? It's technology. But my team hated that I put in place like five or six different tools over the course of a year and you know, kept changing them out when I saw that they wouldn't meet their needs. You know, eventually we settled on the right place, but it's like, I didn't understand change management. I didn't understand getting buy-in. I was complaining to that boss that I didn't have enough technical training, which I was almost laughed out of his office. He said, you don't need technical training. I was sent to Dale Carnegie training, which honestly was outstanding. Mm-hmm. One of the best things that was ever given to me in my career. But even after that, the real difference, I think, with taking responsibility for this problem was, it was something I cared about. And it wasn't something that I could just go off and do. I couldn't configure it away. I couldn't just iterate on it. I literally had to take responsibility for the issue by just being in the suck of it with the other engineers. And I think that was the difference, is like, first place I worked, you know, I was making changes and doing things, you know, both as somebody who could, you know, I started there as the DBA. I was still the production DBA when I was dev team's boss, but I had to do it as a member of the group. You know, when I was working as an engineer and I implemented some of those quality things. But yeah, it really just meant going through and training and teaching and supporting and, you know, being willing to have conversations about, well, is this a defect? Is this not a defect? And not just shouting over like what my opinion should be or feeling right in it, even though I had, you know, more training and stuff in that background. It's like, I really cared about getting the data that we needed to be able to show what we were doing. So I feel like that was the difference.
Mm, yeah. I think from, you know, in my case, like I think back to, you know, 25-year-old me as a manager, and there's this one situation that sticks out in my head where I would have staff meetings, you know, weekly. And we would sit around the table and we'd you know, would kind of review the things where, you know, here's what's going on for the week. And, you know, here's what I, you know, why I'm thinking we need to focus on these things or whatever the case may be. And we were a consulting firm. So at the time, you know, this was, we were taking care of IT, you know, IT needs, servers and that type of stuff. And this is the early mid 2000s. And one of my staff people, he didn't want to do something. And like, it got like contentious where I essentially challenged him openly in front of everyone else. And I'm like, well, you're going to do it. And he's like, what if I don't want to do it? And I'm like, well, you're going to do it because I told you you can do it. You're going to do it. Guess what? I'm the boss. And that's how it works. You know, and like, I would never do that now. You know, like I, you know, you learn like an understanding of where the reservoir of authority actually comes from. And it's not in sitting at the end of the table and pounding your fist on it and being like, you're going to do it, you know, jerk, because I'm the boss. Because guess who's the real jerk in that situation? It's not the person you're calling the jerk. and I can, you know, unfortunately I've had enough time in my life to, you know, this past to be able to, you know, tell that story with understanding that, you know, everybody grows and changes. And it sounds like you've had a journey that, you know, in your way has done that. You know, you're focused on these like metrics and like, if I only get the deliverable or not only get the deliverable, but if I get the deliverables, the rest comes behind it no matter what. And it maybe doesn't matter how we get to the deliverable. If, you know, if I need to ride the team way A versus way B, it, you know, that choice is really inconsequential as long as the deliverable gets met.
Yeah. And you know what though, like you describe in that, like I get like a parallel type like memory of this thing. Cause it's like, for me, it was never about deliverables. It's just like, I'm from the Rust Belt, you know, like my parents are always losing their jobs. And it's like, I guess I always worried about, no matter how good I was, it's just, I knew I could always lose my job and that there were 10 people in line to replace me. You know, maybe there weren't.
Yeah.
But I think I was just always driven by being the best. And I would always try to seek out who the best people were. And I would, you know, idolize them in a way and try to figure out what made them the best, you know? And I think for me, it was probably being a little bit more motivated by, this is how I see the world, you know, in terms of I'm here to work, super professional, you know, it's like, and I don't think that I was old enough yet to see that not everybody sees work that way. And hey, it's okay for other people to not see work that way. Honestly, now I don't even always see work that way.
Some people are just showing up
different.
That's right. Some people are just showing up and they want they're there for the paycheck, and that's okay as long as they do good work.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and recognizing that as a leader is really an important, I've always found that to be an important lesson, because, you know, if you can, you know, there was a earlier episode that I did on the podcast where somebody, you know, highlighted, and these are all things that I, you know, we've all heard before, different things, like not everybody needs to be the team captain, you know, and you shouldn't have the expectation that everybody needs to be the team captain. Sometimes you've just got, you know, people that, you know, they're the pinch hitter and they're really good at being a pinch hitter, and that's totally fine.
But that's how you feel the team. You've got people that can play well in those different positions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel you.
Yeah. So you know, we just talked about things that you did wrong in leadership, but today, you know, you've had the benefit of time to develop, you know, kind of like a more holistic idea about leadership. What are you doing today to lead teams and bring to the table there? What do you try to do to influence those groups?
Number one thing I really try to do is just, I try to be an umbrella for them. I liken it a lot to like, I don't know if you like to ski, but like if you go out west and you drive to the mountains, you know, you'll often see like no stopping next half mile or how long, you know, it says avalanche zone, you know, and sometimes, especially technology teams, you know, they're living in avalanche territory all the time if they're in a reactive state. And maybe this is just relative to what I'm doing right now, but today what I like to do is really try to learn from what I've done before. And it's that I cannot be the individual expert, you know, pinch hitter, team captain, you know, do everything, play all positions. My job is here is to make them look good. And my job is to execute. are really kind of the two things that my mentors have taught me that I've been keeping in my mind lately. And that being said, it makes my job a lot easier sometimes because I don't have to worry so much about being creative or always being visionary. I need to figure out, like, how do I advance this idea? How do I mitigate this pain point for my boss? How do I support everybody? You know, so I find myself actually, that's where my mindset is. Tactically, where I am, I'm doing level two support some days, most days. reporting defects, analyzing budgets. I'm doing all of the mundane things, but they're all done in service of the team, and I find myself proud to do it. Whereas back in the day, I would have been like, well, I should be doing strategy if I'm in a leadership role. It's like, that's what you should do. And it's like, can't really do that if you're not in the weeds. At least that's what I find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, and there's different scale. I mean, like we work in the mid-market space, and I 100% agree with what you're saying, because like I found that the best way to motivate teams, you know, is to let them feel that you not just understand where they're at, but you're willing to get down in with them once in a while and participate and do the work that's there, and that's. That earns you respect, and it earns you, I like to say it earns you grace, so that like, if something goes wrong, they're not like, oh my gosh, like, you know, sure. Darn that Nick guy, you know, my boss, he doesn't know what's up. They'll be like, oh man, Nick's been working with us hard, but like, he's all right. He'll figure it out. And it, you know, and perhaps as you go to scale to larger businesses, you know, if this is, we're talking to the, you know, a software manager at, you know, a company that's got 5,000 employees and 200 developers, like that may not work, you know, that model may not work for them. But I know in our space, that's definitely like you often have to be active in the work. You can't look like you're ruling from on high, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't be more true.
So can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with this Restore for Retail? This is a software development. This is an application you're developing. Is it a platform? What's a little bit to
discuss? Well, a long story short, Restore for Retail is not a new product, but it is new to the US market. Really what we're helping retailers do is kind of streamline their kind of, like, I call it like the local loop of operations. I see use an IT colloquialism here. You've kind of got, how do retailers, you know, with a huge amount of stores, communicate with all of the associates who tend to be, you know, either seasonal employees or part-time employees, and get that kind of consistency on the store floor. I used to see this when I actually worked for REI for a little bit while I was, working as a production DBA. So I could, number one, make some friends with, climbers. Because I didn't know a lot of climbers in Pittsburgh. Didn't meet a lot of climbers in Pittsburgh. But I got some pretty cool gear discounts, which was great. But I remember that I would go to our climbing department, you know, and it's like you go into any retail store and it's like the shelves usually look a certain way. And it's like I'd go into the climbing department and it'd be a mess, you know. So being the climber, you know, I'd put all the chalk bags where they would, you know, supposed to go, you know, I'd size all the runners and put all the carabiners, you know, with all the other light carabiners, black diamond with black diamond, camp with camp. And nobody ever told me how to set up that store. You know, I have no idea if I did it right. What our product does in Restore is you can basically set up a questionnaire. You could set up a planogram or something that you'd like these associates to use on the floor. You can use Restore to distribute the whole thing. And then you can also use Restore to get that information back to your HQ. And it's really cool in the way that it does it. Associates have a mobile app that can go like on their in-store device, or it can go on an iPad or an iPhone. And they basically just like use it to answer survey questions, take photos of things in the store. Sometimes they'll take videos of the store and then submit them, and then you get this like social media stylized gallery, you know, of all the pictures and stuff that are coming in from your store and contextualized to the information that you need to know about it. So it's pretty cool. It's a way, like, I guess it'd be like the retail operations version of DoorDash leaving, taking a photo of what they put on your front porch. But what we've done with that the last 18 months I've been with them, I guess, actually no, it's longer than that. It'll be a year next month. We've completely reshored the dev team. We brought it here to the US. We did some re-architecture, and just honestly, like, a lot of growing. You know, like I said, it came from Australia, so we brought it to the US market, and we're finding a lot of success with it.
Nice. So I'm glad we talked about this, because I want to ask you about leadership with a multinational team, you know. Mm-hmm. So, like, I know you mentioned you brought some of this back, but, you know, you're having to work with, you know, whether it's Australia or other, you know, mm-hmm. resources internationally, that type of leadership can be a little different, you know, because you have to make different considerations and stuff like that. What's different about leadership in that space, which you've recognized?
It's super different, just because, like, now you're getting into, like, a bunch of different cultures. You know, like, the number one most superficially different thing in this situation is dealing with the reality of time zones and the number of hours of overlap that you have each day to get certain things on people's radar, or to get decisions out of them. Another thing can be difficult too is if you're in a reactive state and you need to work with people that are going to be across the place globally, it's pretty hard to do things unless you can have some synchronicity. Like, for instance, you know, I work with, you know, product people and, you know, customer success people on another continent. And it's like, some of the things that they're struggling with are, you know, you could say that's a practice issue, or you could say, well, that's a technical issue. And the only way that you're going to get closer to figuring out what to do about it is to have some synchronicity and get together, you know? So one of the things we implemented over the last couple months was just like a comprehensive new set of meetings, you know, that came out, you know, in accordance with here's the org chart, you know, here's what everybody's role is. Here's how the integrated process works between, like, all of these different departments, all these different people. So really everybody right now knows where they have to be, you know, at a certain time of day, you know, like for our backlog grooming, for our specification workshops, for our standups and our sprint planning. And I mean, these seem like very basic, but when you've got people in one part of the organization that have always built product one way, and you got another group that builds it a different way, and, you know, everybody's got strong preferences and strong personalities, bringing them together can feel like an impossible task, but we've actually found that even though people were kind of fighting, you know, the process and stuff that we were putting in place, no one ever wants to talk about process. But the reality is, it's like, how good would a band be if you went to a concert and everybody was playing everybody else's instrument, you know, and you can tell that nobody had practiced, they're not tight, they're not in tune, they can't agree on anything. That's a lack of process. So, I guess, you know, just trying to harmonize it, it's just like, we needed people to understand, it's like, if you don't have those things ready by this date, we're not going to be able to go with this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of that. It was a lot of education, but, I don't know. Sometimes I don't even know how you can get to the end state without going through what you go through.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say.
Interesting. So, I'm gonna just dive off on a tangent. Sure. Here, and, you know, now I'm gonna go to some more humorous or fun questions. So, yeah, you mentioned you interned at the Coast Guard, yeah. But before that, like, where we asked this question in part because it kind of tells a little bit about what era of technology you came up in. Uh-huh. So what was your first, like, big technology experience that you remember, like computer system, video game, whatever the case may be?
This is a pretty funny story, actually. So there's a guy who used to babysit me. I think he was like a construction guy out on workers' comp, because I think he had, like, lost a toe or something. Interesting guy. He was a gun collector. he was a grape farmer in Western New York. The short of it is, when he wasn't taking me out
shooting guns and stuff. This is your babysitter. Is
it, yes.
So he's missing a toe. He's a construction worker, and he's got a stack of guns. And
yeah,
he's your babysitter.
Of course. I mean, I learned how to shoot an AR-15 from this guy, very, very much responsibly. Of course, this guy was actually a wonderful gun collector. But no, he let me on his computer to play Pac-Man. And it was like, you know, like old school, like DOS Pac-Man from back in the day.
Yeah.
And of course, he said, you know, if you want to quit the game, that use this keystroke to get out of it. I can't remember what it was, but I'm like, okay, I know this keystroke. I would always play it on his computer. Sometime in the near future, I go to somebody else's house and I'm playing some game, and then I do the same keystroke on their computer, and it like doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It does. It said something about the boot record is all I can remember now. Now that I'm older, I can understand. But I remember it freaked these people out, like, oh, you broke our computer and all that. That was actually like, those are the earliest things I remember about computers. My first computer, actually, I didn't get until more than 10 years later. You know, when I was in like ninth grade, I got an HP Pavilion. And it had a 20 gig hard drive.
This is like the early 2000s. If it's got 20 gig hard drives, you know.
Yeah, it had a 4X CD burner. Yeah. I remember, like, because I knew so little about computers even in ninth grade, my English teacher was saying, you need to turn in your homework on this floppy disk. And I was like, but I just got this computer that I can save things on CDs. And it was like some other student had to explain to my teacher what it was. How ironic I became a computer scientist. Hmm.
So now, did that experience, like, you know, were you just always set on the path of being in technology essentially from that point forward? Or was your plan to go do something else?
I grew up wanting to be a neurosurgeon. and I have no doctors in my family or anything like that. But I knew it was the hardest, and that's what I wanted to do. I ended up getting into technology kind of by happenstance. It's like I never really cared about it all that much. I mean, yeah, I played my Game Boy, you know, and I'd sit at a computer and do stuff, but it's like I was no savant technologist at like an early age or anything like that. But I had a friend, I think it was my freshman year of high school, soon after I got my computer, that made websites, made music, did photo editing and design and stuff, like basically all the cool stuff that you could, you know, do on computers back then. He would do it all, and I learned from him. And then my school got a Cisco networking program at their VoTech, and I ended up being like the first class that signed up for it. Mm-hmm. And the moment actually that I really wanted to go into technology was when I learned how a virtual circuit was created in a switch. Mm-hmm. You know, like what makes a switch different than a hub, you know, in terms of like, it doesn't just like, you know, share that connection and split it. You know, it is explaining like how it multiplexes and literally switches between the different connections that are sharing the upstream pipe on that. And always saying this all the wrong way now, but I went on and I earned my CCNA certification, you know, right as I was graduating high school. And, you know, I was so enthralled. I loved networking so much. I was like, I'm going to go all the way to CCIE and I'm going to do this professionally. And honestly,
you're going to be one of those guys showing up at the time. Like when you did the CCIE at the time, you had to like go to a certain space and they'd like walk you into a room with a pile of network equipment that you had no idea what it was. And they'd be like, here's a problem on a piece of paper. You know, we'll come back in 3 hours and see what you've got. And that's like, that's how they evaluated if you were a CCIE or not. You just were thrown some random problem in that you had to figure it out. It was tough.
You're not kidding about it. I mean, I actually, freshman year of college, I went home and I like drove all the way to like Akron, Ohio for like some like Cisco event or something. Cause there was this guy who was a double CCIE who was going to be there. Wow. And I'm shy. I never go talk to strangers. I actually went up and introduced myself to this guy. I was like 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, how did you become a CCIE? And he said, well, I went to school for electrical engineering. I was just like, I was turned off after that. I was like, totally never going to do anything with regard to electrical engineering. But it was great to meet that guy and just see like, just see where he came from. But I remember soon after that, I actually bought a Cisco 2500 series router on eBay for like $50. Mm-hmm. And I would use it to mess around with stuff. And it was fun. Fun times.
I've set up a lot of Cisco 2600. 2600 series in my day. Mm-hmm. And all the early catalysts, because I too had a CCNA back at that time, and that was part of the IT consulting work.
Now I gotta ask, can you still tell me the pinout for an Ethernet cable?
Orange, white, orange, blue. I can't do it. I could start it and end it.
Orange, white, orange, green, white, blue, blue, white, green, Brown, White, Brown.
Brown, yeah.
That is how hardcore I got into it. And I bet if I tried, I could probably still subnet an IP address. But I don't know.
Well, ironically, I live in that a little bit now because I'm on this advisory mm-hmm. board for the American Register for Internet Numbers. Yeah. And our, you know, like Aaron, as it's called, mm-hmm. literally handles handing out IP addresses. It's like the place that's designated for North America to do it. So like, I do policy work for them. And in that process, like I've had to become reacquainted with, you know, classless internet domain routing and subnetting yeah. and all this other stuff like that. And I mean, they work at the more routing level, like BGP yeah. and those types of things, like big time routing stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There was somebody who, she's on the advisory council with me, and he gave a presentation at a conference that I was at recently on it's not new, but it's widely used now in big data centers called CLO networks. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, and at one point he was like, oh, so, you know, if you remember back when you did your CCNA in like 2005, you know, you would set up a network with, you know, spanning tree and multiple links. And this is how the failovers would work and stuff like that. But here's all the ways that like the CLO network, which was invented like, you know, 80 years ago to really for the Bell system, at the, you know, in the 1940s and 50s for physical connections. And it fell out of favor when packet switch networking came into play because the, you know, the like things like spanning tree protocols and stuff like that mm-hmm. took over as the preferred way to build redundancy. But then as the data centers got bigger again, that model doesn't scale. Mm-hmm. And so then all of a sudden, like the CLO network, people were like kind of rediscovered the CLO network topologies, and now it's back. So I'm like watching this thing and I'm like, oh man, I know stuff. Like I am smart.
Yeah, it's just like fashion trends. It's like, you know, people's needs change and they're probably cyclical.
At Dissecting Popular IT Nerds, we expect to win, and we expect our IT directors to win. And one of those areas where we know that we can help you win is internet service providers. As an IT director tasked with managing internet connectivity, few vendor relationships can prove more painfully frustrating than the one with your internet service provider. The array of challenges seems never ending, from unreliable uptime and insufficient bandwidth to poor customer service and hidden fees. It's like getting stuck in rush hour traffic. Dealing with ISPs can try one's patience even on the best of days. So whether you are managing one location or 100 locations, our back office support team and vendor partners are the best in the industry. And the best part about this is none of this will ever cost you a dime due to the partnership and the sponsors that we have behind the scenes at Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. Let us show you how we can manage away the mediocrity and hit it out of the park. We start by mapping all of the available fiber routes, and we use our 1.2 billion in combined customer buying power and massive economy of scale to map all of your locations, to overcome construction fees, to use industry historical data, to encourage providers to compete for the lowest possible pricing, to negotiate the lowest rates guaranteed, and to provide fast response times in hours, not days. And we leverage aggregators and wholesale relationships to ensure you get the best possible pricing available in the marketplace. And on top of all of this, you get proactive network monitoring and proactive alerts so that you're not left calling 1-800-GO-POUND-SAND to enter in a ticket number and wonder, why is my internet connection down? In short, we are the partner that you have always wanted, who understands your needs, your frustrations, and knows what you need without you having to ask. So we're still human, but we are some of the best, and we aim to win. This all starts with a value discovery call where we find out what you have, why you have it, and what's on your roadmap. All you need to do is email internet@popularit.net and say, I want help managing all of my internet garbage. Please make my life easier, and we'll get right on it for you. Have a wonderful day.
Well, I'm going to keep going down the you know, the rabbit hole of things that are not work related here.
Sure.
What can you tell us something about you that non-technical that people may not otherwise know? And I always give an example because I have a list of things, so people randomly learn about me, I guess, in this process too. But I once DJed a wedding. I'm not a DJ, but I did once DJ a wedding. It was nice. What cool or interesting thing? It doesn't have to be a single thing. It could be something you do. I'm just, you know.
Probably the, even if you looked at my LinkedIn profile right now, you'd probably know what I do for fun. But I don't know, if you work with me, would you know that I play guitar? Cause I don't have anything online that you would know about it, but, I don't really,
you are literally talking to us from an awesome recording studio.
With all my babies around me, but no, I don't like just play. I taught myself when I was 13 and I've never gone a week in my life without playing guitar. I've never gone more than 5 days, maybe once. But no, I've got a huge collection of, Mesa amps, which is, it's what, Metallica likes to play through. All my guitars are left-handed. So I've never had a lesson. Love writing and recording my own stuff, but it is something that's weirdly and deeply personal. I don't share it with anybody. So nobody besides like my family and friends really get to hear my music.
Oh, but now on a podcast, there's going to be a bunch of people who will know that you do this stuff. That'd be like, even though they might not hear what you produce, they're going to be like, you know, somebody's going to be like, "Hey, I heard you on this podcast."
I'm working on an album, but I'm never going to say on this podcast that it's going to be done soon or I'm finishing it up, because that's not true. But I am working on it.
I mean, in the studio, of course, you know, you sound great on this podcast, and part of it is because you're in a studio and you have like the mixing board. At one point, I think it is some other meeting you had mentioned that like the soundboard that is run through is like the same one that Metallica's would use.
Well, the secret sauce here is, so I use an Electro Voice RE20 microphone. It's not even an expensive microphone, but it's well known for broadcast. And then I have it running straight into Super Analog Channel 2 of my SSL Solid State Logic 6 mixer. And this thing is a very small version of what you would find in like a big professional studio. And even the channel strip that's on this mixer has a simplified version of like a full SSL EQ and compressor. But I think it sounds excellent. I plug that thing straight into my converter, which is a Universal Audio Apollo X8. I've had other musicians laugh at me that it's like, "Wow, you're running an X8 at home," but yes. that's what runs everything. And I love it. Since I can't play music all the time while I'm working, I can at least enjoy this kind of stuff while I'm on my calls.
No, but you can, and then you sound, you have the Casey Kasem voice when you talk now with this.
I am a big believer, especially like, you know, working in professional services. It's like, you know, if you're working remotely, the number one thing I think you can do, aside from just being very good at what you do and having a great reputation, which I hope I've done both of those, get yourself a good camera, with like, I use a DSLR actually that's mounted here, on my desk with a nice wide angle lens, and get yourself a good microphone and a good interface, meaning get yourself good conversion from analog to digital going into your computer. I think those are the two biggest things that you can do that would set yourself as like a stand apart from everybody. If everything else is equal, we're talking on Zoom and, you know, Teams calls all the time, just upgrade your AV.
Nice. So we're coming to kind of the end here. And one of the things I always make sure to kind of close with our guests is, you know, you've been a leader, we've shared some lessons about things like you, where you felt you failed and maybe, you know, some warning signs of somebody else, but what advice would you give to people out there that are listening? And in our, you know, our market, our people that are listening, our listeners are most often, but not exclusively, you know, people who are, you know, directors of IT, CIOs, managers of large teams and, you know, like DevOps teams and stuff like that. What would you want to share with them about leadership lessons that you've learned that you would give somebody as advice?
I think
dramatic pause.
I asked a question. I take it seriously. I want to think about
right.
it, but,
yeah,
no, I'm really thinking about like, it was so much easier for me to keep myself in check when I worked on a team. And now that I'm a leader, you know, in an executive role, like I find myself alone a lot of the times. And if you're a fan of Saving Private Ryan, you know, gripes don't go down, right? They only go up. So you can't always gripe to your boss. You know, my COO doesn't always want to hear what's bothering me. But, you know, and in a way, I would say like the biggest thing that I would caution anybody else to do is make sure that you've got some downtime, some rest time, and a sounding board. For me, my healthy day to day is playing some guitar and using that to kind of reflect on things. The other thing that I need is a regular time in the wilderness on my raft on a river. So I guess that's my long way of saying you need your own special way to recharge, and only you are going to know what it is. And it's really, really important to regard your own needs as important, especially when you're a leader and you have so much that you're responsible for. Taking care of yourself is something that's easy to not do. So, I don't know. I think that's what I would say, because anytime I feel like griping to somebody, it's probably just because I need to take care of myself a bit.
Mm. That is some sage advice, and that is awesome. I am so glad you shared that. All right. So, Nick, thank you so much for investing your time with us on the podcast today.
My pleasure.
So that's a wrap on today's episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm Doug Kameen, and we look forward to coming to you on our next episode.